Mini episode 751 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Welcome to mini episode 751 of the FDH Lounge. This is FDH managing partner Rick Morris here to introduce our compilation of our finest guest moments from mini episode 651 to 750. We've been privileged to have some outstanding people on the program throughout our history, and this stretch of programming was stellar indeed, with the likes of Matthew Modine, Jeremy Schapp, and Carmine Appice representing. Sit back and enjoy this diverse group talking about anything and everything on the show where nothing is off topic.
I think the first time I threw it out was to Christopher Cross, and the answer that he gave was very revealing, and that is the public is always fascinated by the notion of mailbox money. And I think Christopher Cross was the first to give the answer on this, and everybody else has kind of agreed with it, that basically it's not as much as what you'd think. And that has sort of been the consensus through a period of time. Is it generally inflated in the public sense when they're thinking, oh, these guys get royalties forever, and you can live off of this and that and whatever? Yeah. Is it that inflated in the public mind?
Yeah, totally, especially now, because now there's no record sales like there used to be, you know?
Right.
I mean, you know, when I wrote Do You Think I'm Sexy, and a few years after that, I mean, we were getting royalties between ASCAP and the sales royalties. ASCAP is performance on the radio, which, you know, ran into six figures, you know? Now, the sales part are lucky if they're in four figures, you know?
Right.
So,
yeah, that's
you know,
point.
Right now, a lot of us have sold the rights back to our songs, back to whoever the administrator was, because a 35-year copyright came back to us, and basically you have the right to keep it and get someone else to administrate or renegotiate the deal. In my case, I sold my shares back to my administrator to get a big payment over 3 years, you know, which for that payment, it would take me 30 years at the rate it was going to recoup, you know, so I was better off doing that, you know, because it really, all the sales are so down because of the internet. The internet's killing everything.
Okay, maybe that was just me being Nelson nitpicker a little bit on not seeing a unified theme, but you're making kind of a pretty good case for it, actually. You're kind of persuading me a little bit there, but the one in particular at the Australian newspaper was talking a lot about was Ms. Ashley Graham, who, of course, is getting her notoriety at the moment here for being the best plus-sized model on the cover of Sports Illustrated. And that that thing that she was wearing the other night there, I saw a tweet that I knew I had to quote to you. Somebody said that she looked like a stuffed blood sausage. And I'm looking at these still shots of the front of her with her, there's no tasteful way to say ginormous rack, so I'll just say that. It's cut in various places, hither and there. And I'm looking at it, and I'm thinking to myself, that reminds me of nothing so much as perhaps a weird new kind of superhero logo, and just looking at the mixture of flesh and fabric that was there on her chest. But that was definitely one of the showstoppers of the evening. So I know you got to have some comments on that.
Well, she's a lovely girl. That it just looked like she was wearing the squint-eyed emoji. It was just, an embarrassed red-faced squint-eyed emoji. But I mean, that's just, and it's nothing about her body. I mean, it's great to, as long as you're not in a medical danger zone. If you're plus size and you're rocking it, I am 100% behind you. That style of dress, I don't know anybody that could have pulled off, in my opinion. I just think, I mean, I'm looking at, there was another one, I think, another lady, what the heck was her name again? Another lady who had worn that a dress similar, less detailed, but similar, I think her name was Haley Clawson. And she looked awesome, I thought. I mean, you know, with the same type of dress, but not as much detail. I think that if Ashley didn't have the squint eyes in the emoji, and even if that was more like a bra type of thing, You know, I just kept, when she was walking, I'm like, oh, it's a human version of a squint-eyed emoji. Look at it. There it goes. It's the big two eyes. They're squinting, and it's embarrassed because it's red. And that's, but that's, you shouldn't look like, I always think like when you're wearing an outfit, whether you're a guy or a girl, you shouldn't look like something else that somebody recognizes. Like, it shouldn't be like, there you are, it's the sausage. Or there you are, you know, it looks just like Garfield the cat. And which hers also did. It looked like Garfield was sort of squinting because she also had the points coming up so they could be his ears. But, you know, I just don't ever think with fashion, if you want to be avant-garde, if you want to be different like Rooney Mara, but so you're not exactly looking like something else that somebody can anchor it to, if you know what I mean.
One of the things that I had kind of noticed as well from the TV version was the framing of Mike Nifong. And I have to tell you, my impression was much the same as when I watched Making a Murderer. He was almost sort of getting the treatment of the special prosecutor from that show, which I don't know if that was coincidental or not, but I'd just like to get your thoughts on this because, again, it is a project that, as you had indicated to me, there was, I guess, reasons that you didn't show up on camera here. I was expecting to see you when I was watching it. I didn't know the backstory, but I'm just interested to know your side of the story as far as how they covered it and what they did with the story.
Soon after the book came out, I think in the fall of 2014, the book was optioned by these filmmakers, documentary filmmakers who are highly reputable, had won Oscars for two documentary films they had made previously, and they told me that they had a deal with ESPN where it would be shown as a 30 for 30, and they told me that they, you know, had loved my book and wanted to be true to the story that I laid out in that, and then they paid me for the option, not a lot of money, but they paid me for that option, and they interviewed me at the Brooklyn Navy Yard for 5 or 6 hours. Then we would talk, you know, once or so every month about how it was going. And then at one point they told me they couldn't get – Mike Nifong wouldn't agree to be on camera. And I said, don't worry, I can give you the 20 hours of tape that I had with him when I interviewed him and the transcripts of that. And they said, that's great. We'd really love to have that. We want to use that. And then when the prison where Crystal Mangum is now in Raleigh, North Carolina, wouldn't let them film there, they said, you know, called me again, and they said, I said, don't worry, you can have the transcript of the interview and the tape of the interview that I did with her, because I'm the only one who had done that. And so then I look at the film, and I'm not in it. I'm on the cutting room floor. They didn't use anything from Mike Nifong. They preferred to say that Mike Nifong wouldn't talk to them because that's obviously a storyline that played to something they wanted to say, and they did the same thing with Crystal. So basically the whole other side of the story they left on the cutting room floor, and they just regurgitated the party line of the kids and the kids' parents and the kids' attorneys that this was just a horrible assault on them, that they were innocent bystanders, essentially, in the fiction of Crystal Mangum's making that was with gasoline thrown on it all by a ambitious local prosecutor, Mike Nifong, who just wanted to, who only cared about his re-election and his own political advancement. Well, that is the party line. That is what most people remember. That is what the parents and the kids and their attorneys want people to remember, but that's not, unfortunately, what really happened. That's not the true story. My book is the true story of what happened, and I know a lot of people may hear this and think, there he goes again, this insane human being. But I came to this with no axe to grind whatsoever. I took a blank sheet of paper and started at the beginning and followed all the facts and the details as they happened, and they're all in that book. And so nobody wants to remember what really happened in this case. Nobody wants to remember how these parents of these kids and these kids and their attorneys used their wealth to subvert justice. There was never a trial in this case. They attacked, went on the attack on Mike Nifong. They forced him to recuse himself from the case and turn it over to the state attorney general, who did a secret four-month investigation and declared these kids innocent, which isn't even a word that is used in jurisprudence. This is a total subversion of justice. That's what this is. Now, it worked out great for the kids. They got $20 million each. We'll never know what happened in that bathroom. It didn't work out so great for Crystal Mangum, and it didn't work out so great for Mike Nifong. And by the way, the kids and their parents and their attorneys couldn't be happier about that. But this has nothing to do with justice. This has zero to do with justice. This has to do everything with, you know, being able to manipulate the justice system for your benefit. And as I said, if it were three black kids and one white woman, it never would have happened this way.
Just with you mentioning hockey, that kind of puts me in mind of another conversation that I had, my good friend Russ Cohen from Sportsology, who has said that he doesn't care if hockey's out of the Olympics, that, hey, we got the World Cup this fall. And I said to him, I said, Russ, I love the World Cup. That's going to be awesome. But I said to him, I said, you're in the hockey bubble, my friend. I said, my friends won't be talking to me about that. I live in an area that's not wild about hockey. My friends around here talk to me about hockey during the Olympics when the NHL guys are playing. Not one of them, I think, is going to say to me, hey, did you see what happened in the World Cup game last night? So is baseball just sort of getting to be in its own kind of silo here to where these names just aren't penetrating the mainstream as much, no matter how great they are?
Well, there's something to, you know, to be said for it, because, you know, the argument, in my estimation, is, you know, hockey has certain things. Hockey plays to 93% capacity.
Mm-hmm.
What other sport can claim that? I mean, certainly not the NBA. And hockey has the highest time spent viewing, which is a neat statistic that really is used by a lot of advertisers, which is, you know, they might not have the greatest numbers, but they have the most loyal. And I think the biggest mistake that is made, and that's why the future of podcasts is fascinating, and that's why Blog Talk Radio is doing so well, is part of it is becoming, I want to hear segregated conversation. I don't want to talk about the NHL. I want to talk about my Flyers. I want to talk about my Blue Jackets. And that needs to happen. And as far as baseball is concerned, I think they fall in that same trap. I used to host shows where, you know, the whole idea was to cover 30 teams. And I don't know that I was servicing the audience when I'm talking Red Sox and you're an Astros fan. I don't know that you're helping. I found that in college football. For example, in college football, it is impossible to talk national championship. That's not a conversation, because if you're in Arkansas, you don't care about the Pac-12, and you don't care what Oregon does. And you care about your region. Florida is interested in playing Florida State. And when you're talking about that game, you're ignoring Michigan-Ohio State. And that's why I believe in the future of podcasts, because I'd like to get into my car, and if I'm a sports fan, I want to select my team and listen to content about that.
I wanted to get your thoughts on this. You did a very good job, I thought, on a macro level of addressing it and why people reacted the way that they do. I want to get your thoughts on a micro level, because I go back to a discussion we had on the show a couple of years ago with TV critic Adam Buckman right after the Michael Jackson memorial service on TV, which, again, there's a lot of similarities in the way that people reacted to the two passings. And in terms of why it hit people the way that it did, and my sense on a micro level, I want to get your thoughts on this, is that we mourn them, not even necessarily so much for them, although hopefully there's a part of that as well, but because we have so many memories and so many thoughts from our own lives entangled from it. You hear that music, you get a flashback of a million different things that you've experienced in your life, and maybe you feel like some of those memories are dead now that the person's not here, and that you feel a little bit of sadness because that's something that's kind of slipped away from you. Do you kind of get any sense of that in terms of why we react to these huge stars the way that we do?
Oh, sure. And let's call it what it is. Also, it's very hip on social media to really grieve in a huge way. For me,
yeah.
I tried to just take myself out of the picture. Now, was I a fan? To a degree. You know, the loss of David Bowie, even though he was, 13 years Prince's senior, you know, was a little more, because that was music I listened to, you know, with my dad, my uncles, and all of that growing up. You know, Ziggy Stardust was a regular thing playing in the background. Hey, listen to this nonsense, would be my dad yelling at me as I was trying to say, no, here's Guns N' Roses and Metallica. He's like, no, here's good music. So a lot of, you know, that bond that I had with my uncles, my dad, you know, when all these legends that had passed in 2016 for me, that those were a little more. With Prince, I think part of it, Purple Rain, I mean, how many guys did tribute with Purple Rain? I know a couple of people that have been doing that forever, tying it into their songs. A band that I follow, the Afghan Whigs, have been doing that with one of their songs called Faded for years. But everybody else paid tribute with Purple Rain like they didn't know anything else in the catalog. Come on. Dig a little deeper. And I think that was one of the things that became glaringly clear as well. But part of it is, you know, to me, it was that connection to how we look at sports teams, right? You can always remember the worst times or the best times, who you're with when your team won an important game or had some kind of milestone moment, whatever, a 3-home-run game back at Old Comiskey Park for us, you know, home runs hit on the roof, the no-hitters that Jake Arrieta's throwing, whatever. Those are things that bond you, just like a concert, just like, you know, that favorite music act that you have or that album that still goes deep into your core. And I think, you know, that's a big part of it, is that we relate to it. You know, it's what bonds us, as much as we see all the divisiveness in so many levels in the newscasts that we watch and the political sphere and so on, that, you know, when we look at a musical artist like this, especially when they've been in the eye for 30 years, that's 30 years of our lives that you're going back to. All right, I remember 1983, 84, as Purple Rain was coming out. And while you may not have been tracking Prince all along the way, because he was pretty good about disappearing when he wanted to after the big fight with the record labels producing things, and maybe you knew they came out, maybe you didn't if you had a friend that was really a Prince super fan, as I've been lucky to have a couple of those in my years. They turned me on to some of the later albums where it wasn't much commercial success because he didn't promote it. He didn't go out and support it. He did some one-off concerts here and there, and Save the Forum here in Los Angeles was a big deal. But it's part of the fabric of our lives. I mean, you know, why do we listen to classic rock radio? The music's good, but it's the stories that go with it.
You almost get the sense with some of these trends in the game right now. You know, I always think back to what Mike March did offensively. Turn of the century, greatest show on turf, with what he did with the modernization of the spread offense and putting guys all over the field. And I know a lot of people laughed at him when he drafted Trunk candidate high, and that didn't necessarily work out, but that showed you the kind of guts that he had, drafting him when he already had Marshall Faulk. You almost kind of get the sense, don't you, when you look at the defenses, that we're like one defensive Mike Martz away from this thing really kind of exploding. I mean, they're already doing a lot more. The lines are already getting blurrier, like you said, sometimes between cornerback and safety, maybe with some of these prospects with middle linebacker and safety. But you almost kind of get the sense that if somebody really goes out there and starts to really tinker with things in that way and try to exploit speed in different ways, it's a copycat league. It could be very exciting to see what would happen if a lot of people would follow that trend.
No, absolutely. I mean, great call by you. I'm actually surprised we haven't seen it sooner. You know, I've envisioned situations where you have three true linemen and 7-8 defensive back types just roaming the field. You know, when you have three guys to make sure they protect the gaps, and now so many of these safeties, these big cornerbacks are so physical, you don't mind if they fill the gap in on the run, but you have them out there to cover all the wide receivers and tight ends. And I'm actually more surprised that we haven't seen that sooner than later. Someone with that Bill Belichick, Mike Martz offensive mentality on the defensive side of the ball. Because, and I know lately, you know, poor tackling, people bring it up and, you know, they'll highlight missed tackles. But when you get to the NFL, you know, there are a bunch of safeties out there that are maybe second-string safeties that can cover and can really hit and really tackle. So where you can have eight guys, eight cornerbacks, safeties, roaming around, lining up as linebackers, lining up as outside linebackers, and get you three Vince Wilfork guys up front, I'm surprised we haven't seen that sooner than later. But like you said, once somebody takes a chance, does that, and it works, you're going to see everyone around the NFL do it.
This film itself, Merry Xmas, has been doing well with the awards. Talk about the process of that, how it's gone through.
Yeah, they thought that the short film was going to be a pilot for a series. And Dick Van Dyke suggested it while we were shooting. He said that the family should never actually physically be together. Because in the film, you'll see that we're all talking to each other on the phone. My sister is in China, I'm out in the desert, and Dick Van Dyke is at home, and we're all talking to each other on the phone. And he thought it'd be funny to have a series where the people are never physically in the same space, that they're always having to communicate via telephone or text message or something, you know. And I think it could be an interesting series, you know, if Dick Van Dyke wanted to come play every day. Dick Van Dyke has got more energy than a two-year-old. You just bang two spoons together and make a tune, and he'll start dancing. You know, he'll find a reason to get up out of the chair and start shuffling around. And he's got a beautiful, smart young wife that he's, you know, been with for a few years now. She was a makeup artist, and I don't know if that's how they met, but they're a lovely couple. And it was such a pleasure and honor to work with him.
When we're talking about the man and the performer, something I'd like to ask about that sort of melds the two is the amount of charisma that he had out there on stage. You talked about his greatness as a front man as well as a songwriter. Was it a thing where he would kind of walk out on stage and just kind of flip that switch, or were there elements of that kind of charisma that you would see in the day-to-day life? How much alike was he on stage from off stage, in other words?
Yeah, it wasn't a switch that was flipped. That was him. He was honest. Well, he wasn't out there BSing the crowd. That was him. We could go into a restaurant, and he could put that charisma on, and we'd be in the kitchen cooking. He would do things like that, like, we do this, and we're really big, you know, into food. Can we come back there and check out the kitchen? Oh, yeah, come on back. Hey, you want to flip some stuff? And we'd be in the kitchen. Or he would call up golf courses. Now, I wasn't a big golfer, but all the guys in Warrant are golfers. He'd get them free golfing. And it does help to be in a major rock and roll band, but he had that gift of people reaching out to people and people liking him. He was very likable. And getting back to him walking out on stage, he was such a great front man, and I definitely stood next to him for 5 years and borrowed a lot from him.
One of the things that I've respected about what you guys do, you have a good ability to obviously bounce off of the talent vis-a-vis when things get a little bit absurd. And quite frankly, if anybody wants to go out here, do a YouTube search on Danny Doring Roadkill if you want to hear what I'm talking about. A perfect example of that. You made the little crack about, well, this isn't Meet the Press. That's on the next channel. So I respect that you're able to do that and that you don't take yourself overly seriously and that you're kind of in on the joke when things do cross over to that extreme. And what's interesting, too, is that there's some others, too. Missy Hyatt, she's been on our show. I've seen that from her. She's somebody that's in on the joke and can kind of laugh at stuff when it gets absurd. Does that tend to be more so kind of standard as far as these guys when you're dealing with them, or is the ability to kind of poke fun at yourself or the situation a little bit kind of rare?
Well, you know what? I always say that I'm not in the wrestling business. I'm not in the wrestling industry. You know, I have a production company that covers wrestling. You know, you would say CNN is in politics. You would say CNN covers politics. So, but of course, having been around the characters that permeate the business, the wrestling business, you can find yourself becoming steeled to some of the discussion. So there are some moments where I force myself to step out of myself and be the layperson and listen to the ridiculous story being told, whether it's of a sexual nature and the exploits of some of the wrestlers and their more popular years when they were followed around by, rats is the derogatory term that men used. But,
right.
Or just something so bizarre, the decisions that are made by some of these people. Hearing a story where someone's door's taken off on the side of the highway and they proceed to drive to the city, you know, with no door. So it's easy to lose yourself in what is sometimes standard fare in the discussion with wrestlers. But I have to remind myself that when I'm sitting down hosting a show, I am the viewer. I'm 100% the viewer, and that's the secret. Anyone watching one of our programs, be it a U-Shoot, or something which is kind of uncensored, wild, and that, or even something more of a historical nature, like the Timeline series or Guest Booker, I have to remind myself that I have to be a conduit. I'm kind of channeling our viewers. So I need to ask what's probably on their minds. My reactions should be genuine in that nature, in that I am a viewer when I'm sitting there. And those are the best shows, by the way. When I can lose myself and I'm not worried about the timing or staying on track or where I am in the script versus, you know, how many minutes I've got in the can already. When I can just lose myself in a discussion, like two guys or me and a lady, depending on who the guest is, just losing ourselves in the discussion. Those are the best shows. I think I went 3.5 hours with Roddy Piper. It felt like 6 minutes.
Somebody that I'm a huge fan of, you talk about The Rock back in the day, somebody who I think has the ability, on a smaller level, absolutely, actually, because, again, there's only one Rock. The Rock will never quite be duplicated again. But Sasha Banks, you look at
yes.
the star power that he brings and what is going to be this triple threat match here, which I have to believe is probably the showcase for her to go on top. Somebody who people chant spontaneously for when she's not on a show, which is like unheard of for a woman wrestler. Somebody who, just in my estimation, again, got to stay healthy, whatever, but I mean, at age, what, 23, 24, I think could be on track to be the greatest of all time. And this has the chance to be a launch for her in a match that she says they're going to steal the show at. She may have Snoop Dogg playing her to the ring, her cousin. What are your thoughts on that with the women's match, which I, for the first time maybe in the history of WrestleMania, is highly anticipated?
It's amazing how over she is. Like, I don't know if I've ever
yeah.
seen, and I know, like, women's wrestling for the WWE has certainly changed. I mean, about 10 years ago, well, more than that, 15 years ago, it was simply a chauvinistic, let's see boobs, or as Jerry Lawler, what would Jerry
yep.
Lawler, kitties, the puppies, there you go. It's been so long, I forget how Jerry Lawler was such a pervert on TV. Puppies! That's
right.
What women's wrestling used to be. I've shown that to my wife because my wife is kind enough to actually watch wrestling with me. And we watch Total Divas. Like, it's a really good show. By the way, Sasha Banks should be on Total Divas so we get to know
yes.
her better. I mean, we're all sick of Natty. I mean, how much of Natty and what's her name, the redhead? What's the redhead's name again?
Eva Marie.
Yeah, we can't stand Eva Marie. We're sick of seeing Eva Marie.
Right.
But Sasha Banks is like the most legitimately over woman I've ever seen in pro wrestling. Like, because I say legitimate because with Sable over, I mean, come on. Well, it was oogling. That's all it was. Sasha Banks
right.
is over because she's a really good wrestler, okay?
Yeah.
She's got some personality in the ring. She's got that look in the ring which makes you care about what's happening, you know?
Right.
Which
she's
is very, very impressive. She's captivating.
Yes.
She's captivating. So I don't know what the ceiling is. Like, it's an interesting question to think, okay, what's her ceiling? Because it's the Divas. Like, are they really going to push the Divas to where maybe there's a pay-per-view someday where Sasha Banks is main eventing? I don't know if that's ever going to happen with the WWE. But what we can tell you, and what you know and what I know and everyone knows, is she's got a chance because people love her. People are captivated by her. And if they give the Divas time, because that's the real key, are they going to give them 5 minutes? Are they going to let them fight for 20 minutes? Like, are they going to give them time to put on a good show and tell a story? If they do that and they do give them time, you're right. Like, that has a chance to almost be a show stealer, and it better be her coronation. I mean, there better not be the option of Charlotte retaining or anything like that. Like, she should have her coronation be at WrestleMania winning the Divas title, but you never know.
You've been on top of this Qatar 2022 story for quite some time now, and some of the various disgraces involved in that successful World Cup bid. I'd like to get some thoughts from you on that, and not to ask a political question, but the way that my mind kind of frames this is that when you look in the Arab world and you look at the more recent times, the big divide with the Sunnis and the Shiites, the one that seems to predate that, I think, is rich and poor. And this is a thing where you have to believe if the Arab world itself was united in opposition to what was going on there, that it might be a little bit different. But unfortunately, it seems like it's been this long time pattern of, there's somebody from a poor country, there's refugees from a poor area, and not really seeing the common humanity and the people that are there. So talk about what your perspective has been with that and really how, at a local level and worldwide, this disgrace of all the people who are and I would assume continue to die in the service of making this event happen, how that's continued to materialize.
Yeah, I mean, look, there is no doubt that there are terrible human rights abuses taking place when you're talking about the Gulf countries, these very rich countries in the Gulf that have enjoyed so much wealth and so much growth, in particular over the last generation, you know, whether you're talking about the United Arab Emirates, you know, or Abu Dhabi and Dubai, or you're talking about Qatar. And I've been in Bahrain, too, where there's been terrible stuff going on. But, you know, there has to be, and this was made clear in a recent report by Professor John Ruggie of Harvard, who was hired by FIFA to create a code of ethics, basically, in terms of human rights and their vendors and their contractors and subcontractors. There has to be a standard, and it can't just be some bare minimum. You know, this has to be done better, and you can't have people dying, people from very poor countries dying to build the infrastructure for a World Cup or for any other event. And, you know, I sincerely hope that FIFA is not just paying lip service to this, that they're actually going to incorporate Ruggie's suggestions into any new codes that they create of conduct and partnerships with construction firms and with organizing committees and so forth. But for a long time, you know, they have been oblivious to this, and I think they feel they're being singled out, or that was the feeling certainly when Sepp Blatter was in charge. At the time that they awarded the 2022 tournament to Qatar, you know, no one had even asked the question, who's going to build this? Is it going to be these workers from South Asia, from India and Nepal and Pakistan and Bangladesh? No, it wasn't even a subject for discussion. Certainly, that's changing, and much of that is due to the very good work that's been done by people, organizations, NGOs like Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International who focused on these issues. But, you know, it's too soon to say that there will be change, but certainly it's encouraging to know that pressure is being applied and the world is paying attention.
I have to ask you, too, for somebody who's had the longevity that you have in the business, I have to ask a question. Now, one of my all-time favorite drummers from my all-time favorite group, Neil Peart from Rush, having this chronic tendonitis here that is going to force him to retire as a regular playing drummer, of course, which is kind of a sad thing, not going to be able to tour that much, if at all, anymore. So I'd like to ask you about that, because I've never come across anything with you having any kind of health issues, injuries. So I don't know if I'm missing anything or if you've been fortunate in that regard or if there's a certain kind of training that goes into it to kind of help avoid this kind of stuff. It was something I'd never really thought about before, but there's so much repetitive motion that you've been doing over a period of time. Of course, I can see where that could take a toll. So what has been the story for you?
Well, first of all, it is really sad about Neil, and I actually got really sad when I read his interview where he talked about retiring and the issues that he's had. And I can understand it more in his case, and you know, and it's a little different in my case because he has been playing in Rush for his whole career, and they're a pretty powerful rock band, and he has a style where he plays very hard. So I could see why and how that could happen with him. In my situation, I definitely have had some injuries, but for the most part, I've been able to rehabilitate myself from those and adjust my technique. Because then during, you know, when I found myself having certain injuries, I could figure out what I was doing wrong that was causing those. And some of it is wear and tear, but for instance, like with my traditional grip, where you hold the stick, you know, with the left thumb essentially to the hand, I was having some problems there with one of my joints. Just the cartilage was wearing out. So that's what led me to play more match grip, you know, back to the pathways of motion. So I found that rehabilitated that problem for me, because with the match grip, it's like a little, it's less wear and tear on your hands, So when I play a gig, it's something like 75% to 80% match grip, and I still, you know, then I can play match grip. I mean, traditional grip for 25% of the show, and there's no pain. So that was what my solution to that issue. I've had some rotator cuff tears, not 100% tear, but pretty serious tear. But with yoga and physical therapy, I've worked my way through that, plus adjusting my technique, lowering my cymbals, and just staying really mindful of my touch and sound. And so I don't have any kind of major technical, physical type problems, but I think a lot of it in my case is because I've spent so much time refining my technique and staying within the boundaries of not pushing myself to play louder than necessary. Like, I've found that there's an impact level where I hit the drums where I have a dynamic range from soft, medium to loud, and I stay within that dynamic range no matter what group I'm playing with. And you know, people are asking me now, well, now that you're with Journey, you're going to be playing like really loud and with fat sticks and different heads and all this stuff. And the answer is no. I play exactly the same way that I play with my own band. Really, the only difference is there are more louder tunes than soft tunes, you know. So that will require, you know, some control and conditioning, that because there will be more bigger sounding louder tunes, but it doesn't make me play louder than I play already, whether I'm touring with my own band or somebody else's band. So, and that keeps me from having those injuries, because I keep control of the sound and playing with a good balance, and, you know, with not over smashing cymbals and hitting and breaking sticks. And, you know, I haven't broken a stick in probably 15 to 20 years. So keeping that control improves my sound, so the sound man's really happy, and the onstage volume is not that loud, so there's no need for, you know, plexiglass aquarium around the drum set or anything like that. And so it, you know, so I can just have a nice stage volume where it's musical. And that's really, you know, been my focus, is this musical drumming that feels really good and then has a great overall sound, and then allow the microphones to amplify that through the PA system.
You talk about the timeless elements of it. There are some, and then there are some that are very much of a place in the mid-70s, particularly, again, as has been remarked on, that when there have been remakes of movies subsequently, and you know, Billy Bob Thornton, when he was playing a version of Buttermaker, if you will, subsequently, some of the rough edges are getting sanded off, because that's the nature of today's society, and we're a little bit too sensitive for some of the language that's used in there. So some of the authenticity and some of the rawness of the Bad News Bears stuff, which is, again, part of what really kind of thrilled me as a kid in watching these movies, some of that stuff's gone. So what are your thoughts about how society has changed in the 40 years since, and about how you'd have to kind of water down some of the ways that people were expressing themselves in that movie?
Another great point about a movie that's still being talked about 40 years later. Up until before I knew they were going to make a remake of the movie, I would always tell people that, you know, it was a movie that you couldn't make these days,
right,
because of that language, because of the, you know, the jokes and the political correctness that's kind of around. I would say you couldn't make that movie these days. And you know, all due respect, you know, to the remake, I don't really think that was our movie. It was certainly a different version or another approach, but it wasn't the one we made, because you're right, everything has become a little bit more careful, you know, a little bit more focus group driven, a little bit more, you know, correct. You want to, you don't want to offend. And I certainly understand that. And our movie certainly was of a place and a time where that was not the case, when you could get away with some of that language. And I always tell folks, you know, these days, who find out that I'm in the film and they say, oh, I've got to show my kids that movie, you know, I'm very quick to grab them by the shoulder and say, hey, listen, do me a favor. You know, order it on demand, maybe from, you know, the TV version, or if you're going to rent it or download it, you know, make sure you watch it first, because depending on how old their kids are, you know, it is very possible that it might be inappropriate. If you remember, I'm pretty sure that was a PG movie. They didn't have PG-13. They didn't have, you know, all the small little dichotomies of movie ratings. So I make sure if people are going to watch it with little kids, I make sure to put that disclaimer in there as well.
Let's go with Nova here. Let's talk about that. Congratulations. I will tell you, it was a much better ending to the game for you than it was for me. I was in one of these pools where you draw teams randomly at the beginning, and then you can pick up other teams based on who covers in the game. I ended up inheriting North Carolina part of the way through the tournament. That
wow.
ending cost me 200 bones. I was shrieking at the TV before I turned it off in disgust amidst all the confetti. Safe to say, your reaction, I'm sure, was a lot different than mine.
Just a little bit. And first of all, my condolences. I've taken bad beats. I've been on the other end of shots like that. Trust me, I feel your pain, Rick. But being a graduate of Villanova, and it's been 31 years, and I honestly thought I'd probably never see another one.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, all Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Awkwafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.